Indeed, it is, Charlie. Thanks for putting it in those terms. Chocolate is beloved by generations of people, whether they're religious or not. The focus of my story and my book on the Chocolate Trail is about religious folks who have used chocolate to advance themselves financially, commercially, business-wise, but also loved chocolate for its special magical powers and tastes in their religious observances and ceremonies. So as far back as Mayans and Aztecs, we have, and even before that, actually, we have evidence of chocolate being used in rituals for life cycle events and celebrations of harvests. And nevertheless, as we come to more contemporary religions, I would say that some religious traditions had a bit of ambivalence about chocolate. So weren't sure if they could incorporate chocolate or should incorporate chocolate because of its, in their view, pagan origins.
Well, what makes it an attractive item to use for a ritual or as part of a religious observance in the first place, no matter the denomination or the cultural background of the religious observant?
Initially, Charlie, the indigenous peoples who somehow mysteriously and maybe magically figured out that you could take the seeds from inside a cocoa pod, the seeds that are encased in a white pulp, and somehow figure out that once you ferment those seeds and then roast those seeds and then process those seeds or grind those seeds, you can have a substance that begins to look a little bit like blood, as some ancients believed, and therefore was powerful and essential to human nature. For others, it was perhaps just the opportunity to taste something that wasn't contaminated water. For Europeans, you know, it was an alternative to drinking beer in the days when water was pretty unsanitary and not very hygienic.
We usually think of wine serving that function as a water purifier, though. Why did chocolate have a place in that?
Perhaps because wine was chocolate in its places of origin was pretty available in the places of origin, such as South America and Central America. Wine wasn't really accessible, and in Europe, probably wine was more expensive, and people were drinking beer, so they didn't have access to the more elegant or more sophisticated flavors of wine for the most part. And chocolate allowed those people in Europe to drink something that wasn't alcoholic and was not going to give them a buzz all day long, and maybe also provided a stimulant. So it's the first stimulant drink to arrive in Europe before coffee and tea, and gave people a little bit of additional energy. It was also perhaps a little bit more nutritious, and provided them with alternatives that were, some people believed, more healthful than what they had been drinking.
How does it appear in rituals, and when does it appear in Christian and Jewish rituals? Leaves the New World, once it gets to Europe?
Yeah, in the European contact with chocolate occurs first in the New World. And so in New Spain and Mexico, or Mexico, whichever you want to call it at that point, Jews who were exiled from Spain or chose to leave Spain before the Inquisition actually took too much hold on them, and Catholics who came to the New World both confronted this new drink, and initially they had no idea what it was, and Columbus on the fourth voyage and his crew saw cocoa beans in the bottom of a boat and thought they were almonds and didn't know what to make of it. But gradually Catholics, some Catholic clerics enjoyed chocolate, drank it before they officiated at Mass. Some served it in their meals, celebratory meals. It was said that Oaxacan nuns were the first to add sugar to chocolate and sweeten it. I'm not sure that Catholics were so involved in drinking chocolate as part of a formal ritual, but there are stories a particular bishop prohibited the local women from drinking chocolate during Mass. So we can infer from that that it was customary for people, because Mass was very long, for people to bring their chocolate-making equipment into the church, into the cathedral, and actually drink chocolate while the Mass was happening, and he prohibited it. And then, according to this story reported by Thomas Gage in his report about the New World, the women of Chiapas continued to drink their chocolate, and mysteriously this bishop died of poisoning. And so people were cautioned about drinking the chocolate of Chiapas. Jews, on the other hand, in that setting, in the New World setting, even before, or as it was transitioning to the Old World, they were using chocolate more adeptly and more enthusiastically in their rituals. They were drinking chocolate for the celebration of the beginning of the Sabbath on Friday night, and as part of a blessing known as the Kiddush. They were sharing chocolate balls. It's prepared, ground, and then preserved in ball shape or pellet shape for a while until you're ready for the beverage. It's all a beverage for the early period of European contact. They were using those chocolate balls or pellets as gifts to people who were in mourning, the custom being to give circular foods. This was around food, so they were providing that for the what's called the meal of consolation. They were drinking chocolate just to prepare themselves for the fast of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and also at the end of the Day of Atonement. So Jews were more open, less ambivalent about consumption of chocolate in ritual contexts than I think Catholics were. Catholics had much more of a concern about that pagan contamination that might come from chocolate, since chocolate was used in so many Mayan and Aztec ceremonies.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Rabbi Deborah Prinz about her book, The Chocolate Trail. She's also appearing in a variety of places around Bloomington Normal, including Moses Montefiore Temple and Illinois State University. Once the Inquisition took hold and Jews were forced underground, there was an entire culture of hidden Jews, both in Spain and in the New World. Did chocolate shift in that context, or is that separate from what was happening to Jews at that time?
So Jews were leaving Spain before the formal expulsion for centuries, because the Inquisition actually had been going on for quite a long time. And I think once there was contact with chocolate after Columbus's fourth voyage, Jews who were exiled or had chosen to leave maintained kinship ties and mercantile ties. So even though they were not necessarily in Spain when chocolate first arrived in Spain, they were still part of a network of merchants who were trading chocolate. And as the growing appetite and palate for chocolate developed, they were part of that a kind of extended culture. And so chocolate became a part of the set of opportunities, financial opportunities, that Jews were able to take advantage of. A new food product, they were traveling to new places, they were certainly involved in a number, whatever ventures they could participate in, but they were also involved in chocolate, so that in some parts of the exile or dispersions of Jews from Spain, they became known as chocolate experts, or they had great chocolate expertise, or they were the first to bring chocolate to the area. And we have significant Jewish trade in colonial North America, in Newport and New York, Newport, Rhode Island, and New York City. And some of the folks who were involved to a great extent were some of those exiles, Portuguese and Spanish exiles, who came to the colonies to have freedom of practice. So Jews were involved in the diffusion of chocolate both north and also to the Old World, as were Catholic clerics. So Catholics were they may not have wanted to use chocolate in their customs or ceremonies, but they were partaking of chocolate. In fact, Dominicans were said to have brought Quechua Indians from the New World to the Old World to the Spanish court to demonstrate for the king and the queen how to make and drink chocolate. The first recipe, the first chocolate making equipment was sort of enabled by Dominican clerics. And we have other examples in Spain of Cistercian monasteries where they had chocolate rooms and they have chocolate making equipment and they were known as chocolate makers. Despite the initial reluctance, perhaps in New Spain, there were still Catholic clerics who were involved in also diffusing chocolate through Europe.
Was there economic advantage for them to do so?
Well, I think that as the appetite for chocolate increased, there probably was. The trade grew. Spain initially tried to maintain a monopoly on chocolate. It didn't succeed in doing that. And eventually, a lot of people were trading chocolate amongst other things. At one point, Aaron Lopez in Newport, Rhode Island was trading chocolate, manufacturing chocolate, retailing chocolate. So it gave people lots of opportunities for engaging with chocolate and enhancing their chocolate business. And yes, the attraction, the financial attraction did grow, yes.
Can you give contemporary listeners an idea of the value of this product in those times, in the colonial era and in Spanish colonial periods in the New World? How expensive was it? What did it buy? How much did it take to buy it?
So chocolate in the Old World, what tended to be constrained, or the business of chocolate tended to be constrained in some European countries by monopolies that were gifted or bestowed by the monarchy. And there were high taxes. Plus, there was the shipping cost and the distance. In colonial North America, chocolate tended to be less expensive, partly because of the proximity to chocolate sources, and partly because there were no monopolies and chocolate was not taxed as highly as it was in Europe, so that it was given out as rations to soldiers. It was distributed to prisoners and often given to poor people. So we have a record again of Aaron Lopez, for instance, in Newport, Rhode Island, who was responsible for his congregation to give support to indigent individuals, giving out chocolate balls to poor people along with other foodstuffs. They weren't giving money, they were giving food to folks. So chocolate was one of those things. We think of it as a luxury product. It's much more expensive today. It should be more expensive today, actually, than it is, because our cheaper chocolate or less expensive chocolate is partly the result of West African chocolate, not exclusively, but partly, and over 2 million children in West Africa are enslaved or in child labor in very difficult circumstances. And the farmers who produce cocoa beans in West Africa are basically impoverished. Many of them are extremely poor. So we should be paying more for our chocolate to ameliorate those situations.
We've talked about the trade aspects of chocolate and the religious aspects of chocolate. How about the role of women in chocolate as a cultural artifact?
Thank you for that question. I actually thought about focusing a project around women and chocolate. So initially, women were chocolate makers. They were the ones responsible to hand grind chocolate, which was done on a stone with a metate. It was I've tried it. It's really, really hard to do. And women for a long time in the Mayan, Aztec, Central American, and South American cultures were the chocolate makers. In today's world, there are some women chocolate makers, but a lot of chocolate producers are men. Can't tell you the numbers off the top of my head. And we have a record of just a handful of women in colonial North America who were making chocolate and selling chocolate. In most cases, as far as I can see, they were widows, so they sort of inherited their husband's chocolate company, chocolate making projects. If we say company, it's not at all like a company today. And they were making chocolate. So we know this from North American newspaper advertisements. And one of those women was Rebecca Gomez. But there's just maybe less than two handfuls of women in the business, while there were many more men. So women initially were very, very involved, and then that sort of waned as men took it over.
In colonial North America, you mentioned it was less expensive. Is that partly because it had competition from tea? I mean, how did it interface with other beverage choices in colonial North America?
Yes. So chocolate was very popular. Like, as in Central and South America, there was a significant chocolate culture in North America. People, in some cases, were drinking chocolate for breakfast and for supper. That might have been their whole meal. And that might have a chocolate break during the day. Now, tea and coffee were here as well. However, once the Boston Tea Party happened, it was no longer acceptable to be drinking tea, and coffee and chocolate became the substitutes. And some people who were in the trading business had to certify publicly, taking out advertisements or posters or whatever, that they were not selling tea any longer and they were only selling chocolate and coffee. So chocolate became a substitute for tea. We have evidence, for instance, that George Washington and Martha Washington served chocolate when they had guests in their house at Mount Vernon. They were serving chocolate as well as coffee and tea. So that was later on, but it sort of maintained a place at the table.
Let's return to your point about the bloody cost of chocolate and the exploitive cost of chocolate. How should today's consumers pay attention to those values if they value them, and avoid chocolate that has a taint?
There are a few options. One is, of course, not to eat chocolate at all, which is not an acceptable choice in my opinion, but it is an option. Another option would be to look for a formally certified fair trade chocolate. A fair trade certification means that the fair trade certifier has tried to assess the source of the chocolate and tried to certify that to the degree possible that the chocolate has not come from a West African farm where there might be child slavery or child labor. Another option, which some chocolate companies have chosen to follow, is to be directly in touch with their farmers. So they have what's called modified trade or direct trade with their farmers. They will identify this on their packages or at their websites, and they go to visit the farms themselves, the owners of the companies or their agents go to visit the farms, and they can see once, twice, three times a year what's happening on the ground in terms of who's harvesting the chocolate. So that's another way to ascertain or try to prevent slavery being an ingredient in your chocolate. And finally, another way to do that is to just buy a single origin chocolate, which says on the label the source of where the cocoa beans are raised, the particular plantation or farm, the particular region of a country, or the country of origin for those cocoa beans. Each one of these options is a little bit tricky because a fair trade certifier may or may not be able to get to every farm where cocoa beans are grown. And the single origin option may take you to a South American or a Central American chocolate source, or it might take you to Vietnam, or it might take you to a small part of Hawaii where cocoa beans are grown, which is all delicious and wonderful. But the labeling doesn't necessarily, there's no legislation about the labeling to ensure that it is 100% accurate. It probably is generally, but again, it's a little bit variable. So it's a bit challenging, but hopefully people will find a way that, an avenue, a path that feels comfortable for them in terms of their values and ethics.
Rabbi Deborah Prinz is the author of The Chocolate Trail. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Charlie. Thank you for having me.